Our fourth case for this morning is In Re Dennis Kuntz, the case of Kuntz against Gambino. Mr. Lang.
May it please the court. Mr. Wise. My name is Richard Lang and I represent Dennis Kuntz in this case. Collateral estoppel does not apply to this case because neither actual fraud nor willful intent to injure as defined in the bankruptcy code are essential elements of a slander of title claim, nor are they essential elements of an award of punitive damages.
So here's where I start with your argument, Mr. Lang. Really two things. One, we are of course talking about issue preclusion. And so the real question is how many issues are precluded. The Illinois courts have decided quite a few issues that are pertinent to one or the other of the dischargeability criteria in the bankruptcy code. But the other thing that I guess bothers me about your argument is that the law of issue preclusion itself has evolved over the years and from a direction in which it was extremely strict about all of its criteria, whether it was parties or similarity of issues or the necessity ground, to an issue where many states will say if the earlier court, in our case the Illinois courts, if the earlier court did decide the issue and that's the issue that it grounded the decision on, then we'll take that as decided. So even if, in this case, maybe the Illinois courts didn't have to find malice and fraud and all of that, that was a ground. And boy, they looked pretty clearly to have found that to me.
I agree.
So, I mean, you think they could have ruled on the basis of a lesser showing, but they really seem to have ruled the way they did. So why don't we give that the preclusion?
Well, because the standard that they could have used for the slander of title claim was serious doubts. So this frames.
But they didn't.
Is it your theory? Surely isn't that the Illinois courts affirmed the damages and punitive damages on the theory that Mr. Kuntz just had serious doubts about these documents?
No.
No. Okay.
No.
So you're conceding that they really did decide on the basis of this higher showing, and it's the higher showing that under A6 in particular, 523A6, looks to me like that's the same issue. Serious doubts, I agree with you, would not have been. But the actual findings.
No, I would say that it is not just, and that is exactly the point. My point is it is not what the court said, but what it was required to say.
Now, let me ask, I'm not sure
that's the law.
Well, if it's
let
not
me,
the law,
let me ask you about that, Mr. Kuntz.
Yes.
Let me ask you about that, because I, like Judge Williams, I spent a fair amount of time as a district judge making decisions in cases in which the applicable law was not entirely clear. The on review, the decision could be subject to several different arguable standards, whether it was a fraud or slander of title or anything else. And as a district judge, I would make decisions based on what I thought the facts actually showed, and I'd let the Court of Appeals figure out, in essence, what the legal significance of those findings would be.
Right.
And in a situation like this, maybe I can find for the plaintiff if he just had serious doubts, and if that's all I find, then there's going to be room for debate in the Court of Appeals. But in fact, it's pretty clear there was actual fraud, willful and malicious injury to the plaintiff, so those legal issues become academic. That doesn't sound like dictum, obiter dictum to me.
Well, it is. And if
you're saying it is?
Why is it?
It isn't. It is dictum because it's not essential. To go back to...
But that's just a slogan. You're right, not explaining. Right. If the district judge goes all the way and says, I am my ratio decendi of this case is that I'm finding actual fraud and intent and malice. Because the judge hypothetically could have found less doesn't tell you that he didn't find more.
Yes, but that's not the decisive utterance of the court because that's going beyond what the court needs to decide.
But it formed the basis of the court's decision.
It did form the basis of the court's decision, Judge Williams. But to go back to the first case that your honors had, if you look at it, the holding in Marbury versus Madison is dicta too. It's very powerful dicta. We followed it for 200 years.
That's not the same thing.
But it is dicta.
And the point is that there are two moving parts here. One is what did the Illinois courts actually find? And if it happens that what they actually found is more than they needed to find, they chose a more demanding ground, under Illinois' law of issue preclusion, what happens? And I'm saying, of course, which we follow under 1738, even in a bankruptcy proceeding, and I'm saying that the law of issue preclusion itself has moved in the direction to say that if the earlier court actually did rest its finding on a scale of 1 to 10 on a 10 instead of a 7, then we give issue preclusive effect to the real findings of the court.
Yes.
Which would mean that we would in this case.
And if the court decides that that is the law of collateral estoppel, you will affirm this case. I don't think it is the law of collateral estoppel. It's very clearly stated in the cases. And I think there's a reason for that. If it's not essential to the determination of the court, you can get in this loose thing where the court can kind of go off on something.
But
and
it didn't. This isn't even a case. It used to be the case that if the court gave two alternative rulings, you found that neither one of them was essential to the outcome because the other could always have done it. That's not the law of issue preclusion anymore. If the court says, I'm going to rule on ground A, but in the alternative, which of course district courts and even we do from time to time because there are higher courts out there who might be reviewing what happens, or B, and that's the same sort of thing. You could say neither one is essential, but that's not the law of issue preclusion anymore.
And it's so what the court actually determined in the case. Well, I think that leads to real problems in the case. And first of all, the conclusion that Dennis Kuntz engaged in fraud ignores the fact that he was given notarized deeds.
You want to relitigate everything in the Illinois courts.
No, we only want to litigate the intent of Dennis Kuntz. And the court said, and the lower court said, what difference does his intent make? And Mr. Brown said his intent is not at issue, it's what happened. So if the law of issue preclusion is it's what the court actually decided, and I concede they decided fraud, then I agree with the court. Okay. However, I think the issue is what they had to decide.
Okay, thank you. Fair enough. Mr. Weiss.
May it please the court, Lee Weiss, I represent the estate of Gambino. I think that the courts hit the nail on the head with respect to the questions that they put to Mr. Lang.
So we need to know what Illinois does, because there's no doubt whatsoever that there was a time in American legal history when the law of issue preclusion was every bit as strict as Mr. Lang was describing. And you can look at things like the restatement second of judgments or restatement third, and you can see that it's moving more in a direction, I would say, based on efficiency and based on realism. You know, what did the state court really do? But if Illinois hasn't taken that step yet, it's our duty to follow what Illinois says.
We didn't address that position in our brief. My gut tells me that the court is right towards greater liberality in addressing that, but I can't give you a citation as I stand here right now.
Okay.
I think that the Kuntz position basically ignored what was pled in the state court, what our proofs were in the state court, what Judge Arnold found in the state court, and what was affirmed. Kuntz addressed the issue. In fact, he tried to raise the issue of the existence of fraud.
Let me ask you this question. I mean, the one element that I'm most concerned about, if we were to understand Illinois taking what I'm calling the more strict approach, is willfulness. Because, you know, injury, it seems to me, you can see easily enough in the state court's decision, and it seems to be essential. Maliciousness seems to be essential. Willfulness, though, that's that line between fraud and serious doubts. If it's just serious doubts, a slander of title action might not require the proof of, you know, willfulness to the same degree that the bankruptcy code does.
Well, I think that the willfulness is because of the nature of the forged documents. What else are they trying to do except inflict damage and injury on this specific property owner?
And but is intent to injure an element of a slander of title cause of action? I don't see that it is.
But that's what. But over and above that, that's what we proved, and that's what.
Well, that's the, yeah, right.
So and you got punitive.
Right.
You got
right.
Punitive damages.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And that and that also, yeah, willfulness and malice are necessary.
Is it really the punitives then that you're relying on to show that you got all the way home in state court?
Well, that's primarily what we're saying. But we're also saying when you look at the fraud, when you look at the specific nature of this fraud, 43 forged documents, the fact that Mr. Kuntz and Sal DiBenedetto were working hand in glove. You know, and it's nonsense for Mr. Kuntz to argue, well, gee, I wasn't the one who forged the signature when he had basically his minion doing that kind of dirty work.
So you would agree, though, that not every intent, I mean, we said in First Weber, not every intentional tort is going to translate right over to 523A for non-dischargeability.
No. But when you have a judge who's heard a two-week trial, you know, witness after witness, expert witnesses testifying as to exactly what happened here, we do have that kind of unique intentional tort in which punitive damage based on willfulness and malice were appropriately awarded. Is part of their brief, right at the end, and I think it's probably where it belonged, there's a question as to whether the punitive damage award was something that can be held to be non-dischargeable in this instance, and they cite a couple of bankruptcy cases from the...
You're on page 12?
Yes, right, from the 90s. I think that this court's holding in Jandusa Nikolai speaks exactly to that, where there was an intentional tort. There was $3.4 million in damages awarded, $1.5 million of which was punitive damages. And given the nature of the tort, the court held that the judgment in its entirety was non-dischargeable. It's this court's opinion, not an unreported bankruptcy court opinion.
And it was consistent with several other circuits.
Exactly. In fact, the court went out of its way to look at it, and also it's, you know, it was decided 15 years later. It seems to me that the court has already addressed the issue of whether or not the findings were dicta. Our case was predicated on the fraud and the use of fraud and fraudulent documents, and that was our key. There's nothing that you can look at in the trial court's judgment that would indicate that she premised her ruling on some kind of serious doubts premise.
When did this fraudulent scheme begin?
It began around 03, 04.
Okay, thanks.
I think that there are factors that the court took into account. Mr. Kuntz is a lawyer. In fact, they acknowledge in the reply that he's a real estate lawyer. He's the owner of a title company. He knew what was going on. And their bottom line position that they're entitled to some kind of hearing, notwithstanding their protestations to the contrary, really is an attempt to get a relitigation of what's already been transpired and beaten to death, in the state court. And for that, for those reasons, we think that this court should affirm Judge Lefkoe's decision and hold that the judgment that we received is non-dischargeable in its entirety. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anything further, Mr. Lang?
Just very briefly. Judge Wood, when you were talking about the principles of the Illinois State Court, we had actually looked to the principles of the bankruptcy court in deciding whether there was initially there was a res judicata or collateral estoppel issue. So the cases we cited tended to be federal cases and cases that spoke to that point. And particularly Hunter versus Troop is quite on point on that case. The only other thing I'd like to say is, frankly, I thought Mr. Weiss was attempting to relitigate some of the facts, because that's all we want is a hearing in a bankruptcy court. And the fact that Mr. Sal DiBenedetto forged deeds was not only unknown to Dennis Koontz, it was unknown to a number of other companies and real estate people down the line. So I completely agree with the court that the state court found fraud, but I would disagree, and I don't think this is the appropriate place, but I very, very strongly disagree with the factual predicates for that.
I was just looking at the trial court's findings in the state court.
Okay, thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.